October is the month in which we normally celebrate the Protestant Reformation on October 31st. I think it's appropriate to interrupt our regular routine to focus on a book that deals with one of the watchwords of the Reformation by faith alone. The prophecy of Habakkuk deals with faith, and so we turn our attention to it this morning. Let's hear the word of God from the prophet. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet saw. How long, Yahweh, shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? How long will I cry out to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me look at wickedness, and why do you make me watch misery? Destruction and violence are before me. So strife occurs and disputes arise. Therefore the law proves useless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked man keeps hemming in the righteous. Therefore justice comes out twisted. Look among the nations and see. Be totally astonished, for I'm about to work a work in your days. You will not believe when it is told you. For see, I am raising up the Chaldeans, the bitter and rash nation that goes to the far reaches of the earth to possess dwellings that don't belong to them. They are terrible and fearful. They make their own justice, their own status, and their horses are swifter than leopards, more eager than evening wolves, and their horsemen gallop. Yes, their horsemen will come from a long way off. They will fly like a vulture, rushing in to eat. All of them will come for violence. Their faces are set forward so that they gather up captives like sand. Yet he will scoff at kings. Rulers will give him reason to laugh. He will laugh at every fortress so that he piles up earth ramps and captures it. And then his mood changes so that he passes on. But he has become guilty. His strength is his God. Are you not from ancient times, Yahweh, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. Yahweh, you have appointed him for judgment. O rock, you have established him to punish. Your eyes are too pure to see evil, and you are not able to look on wrong. Why do you look on the treacherous ones? Why are you silent when the wicked swallows up someone more righteous than he? So you've made mankind like the fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them. All of them he pulls out with a hook. He drags them out in his net and gathers them in his dragnet. Therefore, he's glad and ecstatic. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For due to them his portion is rich, his food abundant. Will he then empty his net and keep on killing nations without pity? Upon my watchpost I will stand, and I will take my position upon my tower. So I will look out for what he will speak with me, and for what I must answer when I am reproved. By faith alone is one of the watchwords of the Reformation. By faith we mean essentially this, that right standing with God is not something that we achieve by our so-called best works. But right standing with God is a gift that we receive, purchased by Christ, and received by the empty hand of faith alone. Now it is faith that is the key theme of the prophecy of Habakkuk. He defines, he describes, he depicts what faith is like and what it is about. We don't know anything about Habakkuk. We don't know who his father was or anything. All we know is he was a prophet. Probably prophesied with the material in his book about 607 B.C. And rather unique in the prophetic books, his book is written in dialogue form. He cries out to God and waits God's answers, and so on. There is this give and take with the Lord. The thrust of this section of the prophecy of Habakkuk seems to be this, that true faith often finds itself perplexed at God and sometimes find that God's answers raise even more questions. True faith often finds itself perplexed at God and sometimes finds that God's answers raise even more questions. In other words, what you have here are the quandaries of faith that Habakkuk pressed upon God in his dialogue with him. What are these quandaries as we try to work our way through them and what they mean for us? First, there is the silence of God and human violence. Chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. The silence of God and human violence. Habakkuk cries out with his particular concern with the violence and the injustice that there is in the nation of Judah. You'll notice in verse 4 that he says, "The wicked man keeps hemming in the righteous," so on. What's he talking about? He's talking about people in his own nation of Judah, which is officially, on paper, the people of God. But there are wicked folks, men and women in Judah, who are trampling on those who have no other recourse, those whom Habakkuk calls the righteous, God's true remnant, his true believing people. And they are trampling on them. They may take them to court, but there's no redress. Justice comes out twisted. People can be paid off, you know. And so they are crushing God's believing people, those who have the power to do it, so on. And so you have this violence, so on. And so Habakkuk cries out in their behalf. He asks two questions. How long, Yahweh? Well, shall I cry for help and you will not hear? And so on. It's the silence of God. It's the delay of God, that he doesn't seem to answer or pay attention. And then his question, not only how long, but why? Why? Why do you make me look at wickedness? Why do you make me watch misery? Why is this going on? That is the prophet's concern. Now, that concern for violence is rather contemporary for us, isn't it? Haven't you read and seen recently that cities in our own country are establishing commissions on violence? We're all too familiar with it. Other nations are as well. South Africa, for instance. Recently, a journalist said that along a certain beachfront where he often walked, there was a pavement artist that was murdered by some street children. He said at the same time, there was a friend of his who stopped in a suburb of Johannesburg, stopped for a stop sign. He was set upon by three armed men demanding his car. He was able to get away. His car was riddled with bullets, but he escaped. Police in that section of Johannesburg advise motorists not to stop for red lights after dusk. Violence. But it's been going on for hundreds of years everywhere. Recently, I read a letter from a pastor in the Republic of Macedonia. Now, if you go into Eastern Europe, and especially in the Balkan countries, you'll find a Republic of Macedonia there. And this pastor wrote to some others craving their prayers. This is what he wrote. "Pray that the Lord in his tender mercy will change the course of events here and turn the desires of bloodthirsty men to the fear of God." Then this. "All four bordering nations, Greece, Bulgaria, Serbia, and Albania, are known for nothing else but exterminating each other for 1.5 millennia. Bent on exterminating each other for 1,500 years it's been going on." That doesn't surprise the Christian. It saddens him or her, but it doesn't surprise the Christian, not if the Christian has a biblical understanding of what sin is. Then he or she's not surprised at the violence. But there it is. Human violence, and for Habakkuk, apparently the silence of God. God hasn't done anything to stop it. God hasn't intervened. How long? Why? Etc. We want to back off of that, and how are we going to apply this in our own situation? Well, precisely what was the problem here, though, perhaps we should say first. The problem is not general violence in society, as though that's bad enough, but what Habakkuk is particularly concerned about is why are the powerful and the head knockers and so on, why do they crush God's people, the righteous? Why this believing remnant in Judah? Why are they? Why are God's faithful people being set upon? Why that? That's the particular problem. It's the same kind of problem that was raised in your bulletin insert a week or two. If you saw that note about 3 million Christians in the Sudan who are being forced into resettlement, nicest word, isn't it, to the Islamic North, where they will have to send their children to Islamic schools, and that in many cases food relief that was sent and desperately needed was withheld from Christians because they were Christians, but it was offered to those who were willing to convert to Islam. Why? Why are God's people crushed? Now, the thing I want you, though, to see in this silence of God and this human violence is simply the obvious. I want you to notice that verses 2 through 4 constitute prayer. You say, well, that doesn't take a lot of intelligence to figure out. That's surely the case. But I want you to notice where it is in which Habakkuk raises this problem. He is not sitting in a university library somewhere wondering about the so-called, quote, problem of evil and suffering and wish that he could put together all the pieces. He has taken the position of an intercessor, of one who prays for others and argues their case and brings their need before God. He is praying for them, and in an intercessory prayer, this is what the problem that has become acute. It perhaps wouldn't be stretching it too much to say that for Habakkuk, his problem really arose, or at least was intensified in prayer. That's not the way we're perhaps commonly used to looking upon prayer. Prayer today is often assumed to be a form of therapy. It's therapeutic. It's the way to get yourself into peace of mind, calm yourself down. But it didn't calm Habakkuk down. When you take the position of being an intercessor to pray for others' needs and so on, it may disturb you more than reassure you. I think we need to see that if you're a Christian, you realize that prayer is not always a place of quiet rest. It's a place and time of wrestling with God and pressing these questions upon Him at His feet, especially in the case for others, so that you may find that when you exercise yourself in prayer, it doesn't bring peace to your soul, but that believers who pray will find that they are more and more disturbed and have more dilemmas than those who do not. You may find that you are not reassured, but that you are more disturbed. The silence of God and human violence. On the second quandary, the sovereignty of God and human arrogance. The sovereignty of God and human arrogance. You have this in chapter 1, verses 5 through 11. Now, verses 5 through 11 are God's answer to Habakkuk's prayer. And in the very first verse of that, verse 5, he's not talking directly really to the prophet Habakkuk. The verbs and the words that tell, the pronouns and so on, are plural in verse 5. So God is speaking really to the nation of Judah, to all the Jews. And he's saying to them, look among the nations and see, be totally astonished from about the work of work in your days. You will not believe when it is told you. For see, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, the bitter and rash nation that goes to the far reaches of the earth to possess dwellings that don't belong to them, etc. So he's addressing them. What's he tell them? He says, I'm doing something that is going to utterly surprise and astonish you. It's not far off. I'm going to do it in your days. I am working a work in your days, and it will come to pass in your lifetimes, etc. He's doing something that Habakkuk doesn't exactly answer Habakkuk's prayer. You see, Habakkuk seemed to be praying and wanting something like a chastening that God would bring about so the wicked in Judah would be put down and the righteous would be delivered. But God isn't bringing a partial cleansing or chastening like that. He's going to bring a total judgment upon the nation of Judah, and he's raising up the Chaldeans, that is the Babylonians, in order to do this. So the whole nation is going to be devastated and taken captive in this judgment. The sovereignty of God. See, I am raising up the Chaldeans. He's in control of men and nations, and he is raising the Babylonians up. Now that would be astonishing to anybody at that time. You see, within the scope of about 20 years, the Babylonian Empire came to be the most prominent nation and power in the Near East. One would never have thought it in 626 BC when the Babylonians rebelled against the Assyrians and were successful. And then in 612 BC, they knocked off the Assyrian city of Nineveh. And then in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian, decisively defeated the Egyptians in battle and chased them all the way back to Egypt. At which time, the Babylonians came into control over this little state of Judah and were in control of it until after three waves of deportations that they carried out, they at last decimated it and leveled Jerusalem in 587 BC. But no one would have really thought it. They would have been totally astonished that some power like that, some nation like that, within the scope of 20 years, would come to have the dominant place in the Near East. It would be like for me to tell you today that within 20 years, the nation and country of Paraguay was going to be the leading nation in the world. You would say, oh, believe it. Well, it may or may not. I'm not making a prophecy. I'm just saying it would be that startling to you. Most of you didn't even think that thought today already. It hasn't even come into your head. So foreign is it to you. And that's the way it was, you might say, with this situation. Nobody would have thought that this puppet state of Babylon, etc., would have risen up to such prominence in 20 years. The sovereignty of God. See, I am raising up the Chaldeans. I am going to do this. And yet with that sovereignty, as he describes the instrument he will use, the Lord portrays their human arrogance. He goes on to describe the Babylonians, you know, as he depicts in verse 6 their passion to possess everything that they can get. And when he describes in verses 8 and 9 the efficiency of their military machine. And when he describes in verse 10 their arrogance toward any opposition that stands in their way. And when he describes in verse 11 their idolatry. They worship their own power. And so on. The thing I want you to see here, as far as I think instruction for ourselves, is another piece of instruction about prayer. You notice that when the Lord tells Habakkuk and Judah what he's going to do about the problem of violence and injustice in Judah, when he tells them, it's a surprising thing. It's not exactly what Habakkuk was looking for. Martin Lloyd-Jones has pointed out in his book From Fear to Faith, based on this passage in Habakkuk, but that's frequently the way God seems to work, that his answers to our prayers are often very unexpected, and that sometimes the way in which he answers our prayers creates more mysteries for us than we had when we couldn't understand why he didn't seem to be involving himself in doing anything. Lloyd-Jones makes this point, which I think is instructive. He says, we all tend to prescribe the answers to our prayers. What's he mean? He means something like this. That we just don't lay out the need and the petition, but we also either state or have in our mind the way we think God ought to answer that request and petition. we all tend to prescribe the answers to our prayers. We need to watch that. And then there's also a piece of warning here. You notice this is the sovereignty of God and human arrogance. Here God is sovereign and he's in control of nations. But what kind of nation is he raising up as his instrument of judgment on his own people? Why, it's a pagan nation. The Babylonians. Such arrogant, proud people. Especially you see it in not only verses 10 and 11, but verse 7, the second line. They make their own justice, their own status. If we translated that literally, it would read something like this: their justice and their majesty come forth from themselves. That is, that they are their own source of law, of status. We have a word for this, if you like long-handled terms: autonomy. That is, they are the ones who are in control. They are the ones who will call the shots. And why is that so? Because they have determined it. It is going to be so. The point of warning comes here. Don't think that this human arrogance is a Babylonian disease. Every man and woman has a Babylon within his or her own heart. Perhaps nicer, but still the same. I told you once about the, I think, interviews in Robert Bellah's book, Habits of the Heart, in which he interviewed various folks, and about this one woman whose name was Sheila, who described the way she functioned. She said, "I believe in God. I don't remember when I was in church last, but my faith has taken me through a lot. This is her faith, it's Sheilaism. Just my own little voice." Now, it sounds religious, and it is religious, but it's not true faith. You see what it is? It's Babylonian. That's what it is. Sheilaism, just my own little voice. What's she mean? My law and my status come from I determine what I do. What pleases me, if it pleases me, I will do it. I may give allegiance to the Scripture and to the Bible if it suits me, but when push comes to shove, what I do and the way I take, what I determine, will be done by what my little voice says. It's just Babylon all over again. And you will have that human arrogance unchecked and untamed within you unless the Lord Jesus Christ has tamed it and drawn its sting. The sovereignty of God and human arrogance. Don't think Babylon has a corner on arrogance. Third quandary, the worship of God and human hope. The worship of God and human hope. Perhaps not so much a quandary as a paradox. Verse 12. Habakkuk is going now, in verse 12, to begin to respond to what Yahweh has just told him. But notice that he begins in worship. "Are you not from ancient times, Yahweh, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. Yahweh, you have appointed him," that is the Babylonian, "for judgment. O rock, you have established him to punish." Now notice, Habakkuk is going to have more problems with God's solution. That here is violence and injustice in Judah, and the Lord says, "Well, I'm raising up the Babylonians, and they are going to devastate Judah in judgment." Well, this is going to cause more problems for Habakkuk, as we'll see in a moment. But before he gets into the problem, notice what he does. In his prayer, he worships. He adores God. "Are you not from ancient times, Yahweh, my God, my Holy One?"
And it is while he is adoring God that he has this stab of reassurance, even though he doesn't have his problem solved, even though not all the pieces have landed in order at all. But on the basis of that, he says, we will not die. Two words in Hebrew. We will not die. And he has this reassurance. But when does it come? It comes when he's adoring God in worship. Now, what's that adoration consist of? Notice he says, are you not from ancient times? That could also be translated, are you not from eternity? But the term also can sometimes mean ancient times, that is, in years past. And that's the way it's used in, for instance, Psalm 77. What Habakkuk may well be saying is, Lord, back when you delivered our people from Egypt and brought them out of bondage and preserved them, you were there then. And if you did that then surely you're not going to let go of your people now. He calls him Yahweh, my God. This God who has promised to be God to his people so that they can say, Habakkuk can say, he is my God. And if he is my God and has pledged himself to me, then he will not let go of his people at any point. My Holy One. Notice that he calls him his rock, or O rock, in the last line of verse 12. Here is their stability. Here is Habakkuk's stability. The stability of the believing remnant in Judah. But the thing I want you to see here is that when he engages in this, it's when he engages in this act of adoration and praise in his prayer that the reassurance comes. Just momentary, but it's there. We will not die somehow. No matter whether the Babylonians come in and decimate Judah and ravage it as they will, nevertheless, somehow, some way, God's believing people will not be eliminated. We will not die. And he finds that when he's worshiping, not when he's attacking his problem directly. I think it's important to see that. Now, I urge on you then, in the quandaries and dilemmas of your faith, that you not necessarily go attacking the perplexity head on, because you may never figure it out, but there is something you can do. In your prayer, you can learn to worship and adore God. And often when you are involved in that activity, strangely enough, then is when some assurance will come to you. I don't know as we're used to that, though, because when we pray, I think in our, not that we don't think that prayer is an act of worship, I think we do, but in our contemporary church culture, as we have it among Christians today, we don't exercise much worship or adoration usually in prayer. What do I mean by that? No, I mean this, that oftentimes prayer is reduced almost to constantly, almost completely petition, in which we have to cover our turf, because on Tuesday I pray for this list of items on my list and I want to get clear through them and get my grocery list covered in my prayers. Nothing wrong with prayer lists as such, no. But it's as if it's utterly devoid. We tend to think of prayer as a way of therapy, managing our stress. And sometimes it becomes so crass that it's almost our way and our technique of using God merely for our own peace of mind. And how little do we know of the practice of adoration in prayer? That focuses not upon myself but upon my God and says, are you not from eternity, O Yahweh, my God, my Holy One? Now, I would have to say this as well, and that is that this applies not only on a national level or with all of God's people, this kind of assurance, but I think you should know that if we have this kind of God, it applies on the individual level, that the same assurance comes, we will not die. You see, let me give you an example. It was James Guthrie, the Scottish Covenanter, who was on the scaffold about to have his head chopped off for his faith and for his adherence to the truth in the 1600s in Scotland. What was it that were almost the next to the last words that James Guthrie said and called out as his head was about to roll? They were the words from Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 12, somewhat quoted and paraphrased and applied in his own case. And this is what he said: "Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? I shall not die." Of course he's going to die. His head just rolled. No. No, he meant that if he had this God who was from eternity, that this eternal God could keep his people to eternity even through death. And that if this God promised to be a God to him, he could still call him my God even before his head rolled off the scaffold. And he would not die, because that eternal God who committed himself to him would keep his grip on him even through death. The worship of God and human hope. Now, fourthly, there is one more quandary that Habakkuk raises, and that is the character of God and human history. The character of God and human history, chapter 1, verses 13 to 17. Now Habakkuk raises his problem that he has. "Your eyes," he says in verse 13, "are too pure to see evil, and you are not able to look on wrong. Why do you look on the treacherous ones, the Babylonians? Why are you silent when the wicked swallows up someone more righteous than he?" Habakkuk has a problem. He acknowledges that God is holy, that he's righteous, that he's just. But if that's the case, he doesn't seem to be operating in terms of justice and what's fair and what's right if he uses the pagan Babylonians to wipe out his own professing people of Judah. Where is justice in that? That doesn't seem proper and right. And he goes on to describe this operations of the Babylonians in their conquest. He describes them under the figure of people who are fishing. It's really the military conquests of the Babylonians. It's as if people are people. They're things. They're fish. They're slugs. They're creeping things. And they just gather them up in their net. They collect them all. Their conquests. And then their idolatry based on it. They worship, verse 16, their own military power. And Habakkuk asked the question, is he just, verse 17, to go on with this relentlessly, emptying his net, keep on killing nations without pity? What about this Babylonian? What's going to be done to him? But you see the main issue that Habakkuk raises in verse 13. You, O Lord, are a holy God. I just called you that. You are just and righteous. But how then? Verse 13. How can you countenance when the wicked swallows up someone more righteous than he? That is, relatively speaking, Judah may be wicked. I've prayed about that, Lord. But Judah is not officially pagan. They're not like the Babylonians. Yes, Judah is sinful and rebellious. But at least there are some of your people there. Relatively speaking, Judah is more righteous than Babylon. How then can you use this crassly pagan nation of Babylon to judge your people Judah? That gets a little close to home. Have you ever thought that the United States of America will never be judged by God, or at least not soon, in any dramatic way? Because after all, there are so many millions of Christians in this country. And after all, what would become of missionary efforts across the world without the United States dollars of United States Christians? And I think what Habakkuk is implying in this section is that long after the United States of America may be layered in ashes, the God of the Bible will still be holy and healthy, and he doesn't need our dollars to subsidize his kingdom. Do you see the implicit teaching of this text? It is that God may, perplexing as it seems, God may use what we think is a less righteous or a more wicked nation to punish and to judge another nation or people that doesn't seem to be as wicked, relatively speaking, in our estimation. And we may say, well, we're not godless communists here. The teaching is, he could be saying to us, I am raising up the Chaldeans. Or it may not be another nation. He could be saying, I am raising up Islam. Or he could be saying, I am raising up economic hardship or whatever. The character of God and human history. You see what this really teaches us, to boil it down from even more than the national level to the personal level. You see what this really teaches us in verse 13 is this, that whether on the national level or the personal level, we cannot trust our own estimate of our righteousness. We can't trust the relative value of our good works. Let me try to focus that. Daily Bread a long time ago contained a story about a wealthy farmer, and he had a hired man who was a Christian. This hired man sought to witness with the gospel to his employer, and the employer, the farmer, said this, I'll admit I'm not perfect. I get pretty angry sometimes. I swear a little, and I sometimes tell a lie, but I don't cheat people, and I give liberally to good causes. I figure I'm better than the average individual, with enough good points to offset my weaknesses. This should get me into heaven. And so that evening, the hired hand who had testified to his boss came in from working on a fence. And the farmer said, well, Jack, is the fence all tight and strong? Well, the hired hand replied this way, I can't say that it's perfect, but it ought to do. Some parts are a little weak, but others are extra firm. There are a few gaps in it, but I made up for them by doubling the rails on each side of the opening. Perhaps it's not entirely satisfactory, but considering everything, it strikes a good average. Well, the farmer exploded, and he said, why, you might as well not have built a fence at all if there's even one weak spot. The cattle will find it and go through. It must be perfect or it's worthless. Hired man says, I used to think so. But I've heard you talking so much about averaging matters with the Lord, it seemed to me we might try the same logic with the cattle. You see, we really can't trust our estimate of relative righteousness or wickedness. And that's what Habakkuk is saying at bottom here. The only thing I can trust is if, as we sang earlier, I have a foreign righteousness that is given to me by Jesus Christ. Character of God of human history. You don't solve the question. Habakkuk in chapter 2, verse 1 doesn't get an answer yet. He's waiting for more light. That's not bad. You can go through all your quandaries of faith, and at the end you still have to be waiting for more light. But there's something else you can do. Verse 12, you can worship. You can wait, and you can worship. We should respond to the keeping of our God using number 374, stanza 2.